Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 738, Turkish Taffy, Part 2. This program is being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2011. We're going to jump right back in where we left off at the end of Side 1. We have been reading from an article from the New York Times of March 24th of 2011. It's by Michael Slackman, Dateline Cairo, headlined, Islamist Group is Rising Force in a New Egypt, and it is about the Muslim Brotherhood and an apparent deal that it may have cut with the army, and it is now, as many people had said would be the case, emerging as the dominant political force on the Egyptian landscape. We're going to jump right into this article where we left off, talking about Essam El Arian, a leader of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, an individual who was featured on the op-ed page of the New York Times. We're going to reread a section of his op-ed piece, and he basically is quoted in this article. We are not keen for power, unquote. He would not comment, Mr. Arian said, he would not comment on whether the Brotherhood had an arrangement with the military, but he said the will of the people to shift toward Islam spoke for itself and was a sign of Egypt's emerging democratic values. Don't trust the intellectuals, liberals, and secularists, Mr. Arian said. They are a minor group crying all the time. If they don't work hard, they have no future, unquote. But the more secular forces say what they need is time. I worry about going too fast towards elections, that the parties are still weak, said Nabil Ahmed Helmi, former dean of the Zagazig Law School and a member of the National Council for Human Rights. Quote, the only thing left right now is the Muslim Brotherhood. I do think that people are trying to take over the revolution. Unquote. Well, that had been the fear expressed by many, including yours truly. I wondered if perhaps what we were witnessing in Egypt would end up like the Russian Revolution, in which the pro-democracy Mensheviks were quickly ousted by the Bolsheviks. And who knows? That seems to be what is going on. One thing to an extent, obviously it's not Bolsheviks, it's from the ideological opposite, although subjectively I think much of the same sorts of behavior might be expected. One of the things that I think we need to really take stock of, and again, this is goes along with the principle of taqiyya, in which Islamists, devout Muslims engaged in warfare, open warfare, or political struggle with non-Muslims are basically required as a matter of doctrine to lie to the non-Muslims about matters of importance. The nice sounding words that were voiced by Essam El Arian of the Muslim Brotherhood, talking about how, yes, we believe in democracy and parliamentary values and so forth, I think is to be assessed against the background of the Muslim Brotherhood proper. Once again, I'm going to reiterate a little bit of what we talked about in For the Record 736. On February 8th of 2011, Tariq Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, had an op-ed column in the New York Times called Wither the Muslim Brotherhood, and in it he just flat out lied. Reviewing a section of that column, the Muslim Brothers began in the 1930s as a legalist, anti-colonialist, and nonviolent movement that claimed legitimacy for armed resistance in Palestine against Zionist expansionism during the period before World War II. The writings from between 1930 and 1945 of Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Brotherhood, show that he opposed colonialism and strongly criticized the fascist governments in Germany and Italy. He rejected the use of violence in Egypt, even though he considered it legitimate in Palestine, in resistance to the Zionist Stern and Irgun terror gangs. And then the following day, February 9th, the aforementioned Essam El Arian had an op-ed column in the New York Times, and this was called What the Muslim Brothers Want, and in it he is quoted as follows, skipping down, in more than eight decades of activism, the Muslim Brotherhood has consistently promoted an agenda of gradual reform. Our principles, clearly stated since the inception of the movement in 1928, affirm an unequivocal position against violence. This is a flat out lie. It is basically the same lie. Again, the Brotherhood was actually an ally of the Axis in World War II, and they did not reject violence. That is, simply put, a lie. What we're going to do is to reread a section of and read again a portion that we had not read from the book Cairo to Damascus by John Roy Carlson. The book was published in hardcover in 1952. You can download the entire book for free from the SpitfireList.com website. The PDF files for all of the books available on Spitfire, old, long-out-of-print anti-fascist books. They're on very compact, easy-to-use PDF files. All you got to do is print them up, as is download them and print them up. And in Cairo to Damascus, there's an entire chapter called the Muslim, quote, in parentheses, Black Brotherhood, about the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, Hassan al-Banna was assassinated in 1948. This book was published in early 52. And so what we're talking about here, actually, I think it was 51. I'd have to double-check from the actual text. But again, the book is available in its entirety for download for free on the Spitfire website. And John Roy Carlson himself, posing as a Muslim, he was of Armenian extraction, so physically he was able to pull off this ruse. He actually infiltrated Islamist society in Egypt, and in addition to reporting about the Muslim Brotherhood, was actually able to get an interview with Hassan al-Banna. Now, keeping in mind those two columns, again, we talked about those in For the Record 736, both of them just outright lies, consider the following, this from the time. The Murshid, by the way, is the supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is its founder, in this case, Hassan al-Banna. He has since been replaced as Murshid. Of course, he's been dead since 1948. In writing of this nice, peaceful organization against which has supposedly rejected violence in Egypt for decades, and so just the pure hocus-pocus we heard from Tariq Ramadan and Assam al-Aryan, this is the reality that they were willfully covering up. The Murshid maintained espionage squads everywhere. He also had a special assassin squad entrusted with the duty of liquidating political opponents. Al-Banna resented a verdict that Judge Ahmed El-Kazindar Bey meted out against a Muslim brother and ordered him liquidated. One of the Murshid's henchmen took care of this assignment, aided by an assistant who pumped six bullets into the judge. Under public pressure, Cairo's police chief staged a few raids and made a few arrests. Al-Banna was annoyed with this, too. He ordered his terror squad to, quote, teach the police chief a lesson, unquote. The latter was promptly killed by a hand grenade while on a tour of inspection of Fuad University. When the president of Fuad complained, he was denounced as a, quote, European, unquote, publicly insulted, and narrowly missed being shot. Al-Banna played for high stakes. Not content with liquidating a judge and a police chief, he ordered Abdelmajid Ahmed Hassan, a 23-year-old student with a member of his terror squad, to carry out his duty to Allah. A religious sheikh told Hassan that the Quran sanctioned the murder of the, quote, enemies of Islam and of Arabism, unquote, whereupon Hassan dutifully swore to kill any traitor the Murshid named. Hassan retired and spent his days in meditation, prayer, and preparation. On the 10th day after his oath, he donned a policeman's uniform and went to the Ministry of the Interior, where he waited for the Egyptian Prime Minister Mahmoud Fahmi el-Nukrashi Pasha to emerge. As soon as Nakrashi Pasha appeared, followed by his bodyguard, Abdel whipped out a pistol and shot the minister dead, his duty to the Murshid and to Allah fulfilled, his place in heaven assured. All that I had learned about Hassan al-Banna and the unquestioned loyalty he inspired in his cutthroats only whetted my desire to meet him. It proved more difficult than I expected because of his deep hatred of, quote, Europeans, unquote. Finally, one day, accompanied by my friend Gamal, I walked into Ikhwan headquarters for my audience with Hassan al-Banna, the supreme guide. He approached us, a short, squat, ratty-faced man with puffed cheeks and fleshy nose. He was dressed in European clothes, a black pinpoint double-breasted suit, and wore an extra-tall tarbouche, which gave him the illusion of added height. His thin beard, running from ear to ear, crawled up then down his upper lip, like an ugly black hirsute vine. His manner was mousy and furtive. His eyes, bead-like and deep-set, were like two dark slits across his face. We sat in the shade under the shield showing the Quran above a pair of crossed swords. The Murshid spoke with a pious look on his face, his head bent slightly to the right, hands folded meekly in his lap. I disliked him instantly and thoroughly. He was the most loathsome man I had met yet in Cairo. Kamal sat next to us and faithfully interpreted. Quote, "The Quran should be Egypt's constitution, for there is no law higher than the Quranic law," unquote, the Murshid began. "We seek to fulfill the lofty human message of Islam, which has brought happiness and fulfillment to mankind in centuries past. Ours is the highest ideal, the holiest cause, and the purest way. Those who criticize us have fed from the tables of Europe. They want to live as Europe has taught them, to dance, to drink, to revel, to mix the sexes openly and in public," unquote. Sounds kind of like what we've been hearing from contemporary Muslim brothers in some of the articles I just read. Continuing, I asked his views on establishing the caliphate, the complete merger of church and state, the Muslim equivalent of religious totalitarianism as in Spain. Quote, "We want an Arabian United States with a caliphate at its head and every Arab state subscribing wholeheartedly to the laws of the Quran. We must return to the Quran, which preaches the good life, which forbids us to take bribes, to cheat, to kill one's brother. The laws of the Quran are suitable for all men at all times to the end of the world. This is the day, and this is the time when the world needs Islam most," unquote. I could not help making a mental note that the word Christian, unquote, had been similarly used and with similar fanaticism among Western exponents of authoritarianism. Quote, "We are not eager to have a parliament of the representatives of the people," the Supreme Guide continued, "or a cabinet of ministers, unless such representatives and ministers are Quranic Muslims. If we do not find them, then we must ourselves serve as the parliament. Allah and the religious councils will limit our authority so that no one has to fear dictatorship. We aim to smash modernism in government and society. In Palestine, our first duty as Muslims is to crush Zionism, which is Jewish modernism. It is our patriotic duty. The Quran commands it," unquote. He was silent and then nodded to indicate the interview was over. And with this, Kamal and I took leave of Ikhwan's Murshid and Egypt's Rasputin. "What do you think of our Murshid?" Kamal asked. "He is a holy man," I said. So again, note some of the pronouncements there in that interview with Hassan al-Banna. I'm not going to hear a whole lot of interviews, and the niceties that are being mouthed by Assam El-Aryan and Tariq Ramadan, that the Brotherhood has always been nonviolent, rejected the use of violence in Egypt, and the niceties about the parliamentary instincts. Assam El-Aryan said basically he would not comment on whether, going back to the New York Times article from March 24th, from which we were just reading, he would not comment on whether the Brotherhood had an arrangement with the military, but he said the will of the people to shift toward Islam spoke for itself and was a sign of Egypt's emerging democratic values. "Don't trust the intellectuals, liberals, and secularists," Mr. Aryan said. "They are a minor group crying all the time. If they don't work hard, they have no future." So again, the sort of parliamentary democracy that Hassan al-Banna envisioned, very different from what leaders of Egypt's revolution initially envisioned, I dare say. Again, note what Tariq Ramadan and Assam El-Aryan were saying on the op-ed pages of the New York Times. Flat out, bald face, bleeping lies. No two ways about it. Another New York Times article, which basically gives the lie to a lot of their op-ed page. This from yesterday, Saturday, April 2nd of 2011, article by Neil Farquhar, Stateline Nahia, Egypt, headline, "Radicals Turn to Democracy Alarms Egypt." And the cutting edge, so to speak, of the Brotherhood milieu is beginning to make its presence felt. The article reads in part, "Aboud al-Zamour, the former intelligence officer who supplied the bullets that killed President Anwar al-Sadat and is Egypt's most notorious newly released prisoner, waxes enthusiastic about ending the violent jihad he once led." Quote, The ballot boxes will decide who will win at the end of the day, unquote, Mr. Zamora said during the interview in his large family compound in this hamlet on Cairo's western edge. Again, quoting, "There is no longer any need for me to use violence against those who gave us our freedom and allowed us to be part of political life," unquote. In its drive to create a perfect Islamic state, his Islamic group and other groups like it were once synonymous with some of the bloodiest terrorist attacks in Egypt. But they are now leaping aboard the democracy bandwagon, alarming those who believe that religious radicals are seeking to put in place strict Islamic law through ballots. The public approval of the constitutional amendments on March 19th provided an early example of Islamist political muscle. The victory achieved in no small part by framing the yes vote as a religious duty, but perhaps the most surprising aspect of the Islamist campaign was the energy invested by religious organizations that once damned the democratic process as a Western infidel innovation masterminded to undermine God's laws. Mr. Zamora, 64, with his bushy gray beard and nearly 30 years in prison, has emerged as a high-profile spokesman for that sea change since he was released on March 12th. He and other Salafis or Islamic fundamentalists rhapsodize about founding political parties and forging alliances with the more mainstream Muslim Brotherhood to maximize the religious vote. Skipping down. In an example of fundamentalists now emerging into public light, the sons of Omar Abdel Rahman, the blind sheikh who was serving a life sentence in the United States, convicted in a conspiracy to bomb the World Trade Center in 1993, recently addressed a conference at a five-star Cairo hotel demanding that the United States release their ailing father. "Somebody wants to give the impression that democracy will bring about the worst in Egypt," said Hassam Tamam, an expert on Salafi groups. Well, I don't know about that. I think it may well be that simply the Brotherhood is fulfilling its destiny. A couple of points. Sheikh Rahman was one of the driving forces behind the assassination of Anwar Sadat, which was very closely linked with Muslim Brotherhood groups. I would also note that, of course, Sheikh Rahman was convicted in connection with the conspiracy to blow up the World Trade Center and other landmarks in New York City. There are strong links between the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center and the September 11th attacks themselves. And it's very interesting indeed to see Sheikh Rahman's sons now prancing about Egypt and calling for the release of their father. Again, some of the forces that had conspired to assassinate Anwar al-Sadat now free and exercising, quote, their democratic instincts, unquote, on the Egyptian political landscape. I am not in the least little bit optimistic about what is going to come out of this. I guess that's fairly obvious, but a lot of very, very interesting things to keep our eyes out for. One of the things that we're told is that, well, we really should not worry about the Brotherhood because they're going to be moderates just like the moderates in Turkey. What we're going to do, and this was, again, in the op-ed column by Tariq Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, what he said, again, in the New York Times of February 8, 2011, "Today's Muslim Brotherhood draws these diverse visions together, but the leadership of the movement, those who belong to the founding generation, are now very old, no longer fully represents the aspirations of the younger members, who are much more open to the world, anxious to bring about internal reform, and fascinated by the Turkish example." Well, they're fascinated by the Turkish example, and let's once again review the Turkish taffy, this sweetened confection. Again, we're told they're very moderate. We're going to go back into the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBaviere, published in softcover in 2000 by Algora Press. And the individual in question here is Ahmed Huber, a protege of the Grand Mufti himself, who held the rank of general in the Waffen-SS. And Ahmed Huber was also a protege of Omar Amin von Leers, Johann von Leers. He was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for the Third Reich and Goebbels' propaganda ministry, converted to Islam, and was appointed by Nasser as to be head of the Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote. Direct links between Ahmed Huber and the milieu of the SS. And as we've seen in past discussions, Ahmed Huber also serving as liaison between Islamic fascists and European and American counterparts. Now, what we're being told is that Mr. Erdogan's AK party is moderate. Actually, it evolved from the Refah party and his, that is to say, Erdogan's mentor, Mehmet Erbakan. And they are then the association here between Erbakan and the Refah party and the aforementioned Ahmed Huber described by Richard LaBeviere as follows. Quote, "Some observers say the attempt to reform its public image could be at least partly linked to the rise of Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan and his AK party. Coming to power in a landslide victory last year, Erdogan styles his party as a modern conservative group based on Muslim values. He has distanced himself from former mentor Necmettin Erbakan, who founded the Islamic-influenced Welfare Party. Erbakan's nephew, Mehmet Sabri Erbakan, was IGMG chairman until he left office after allegedly having an extramarital affair. Closely associated with the AK party's predecessor Refah organization, Huber's concept of moderation, I think, can be fairly weighed by the following. Again, quoting from Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere of the decor of Ahmed Huber's residence in Switzerland, a second photograph in which Hitler is talking with Himmler hangs next to those of Necmettin Erbakan and Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of the fascist Front National. Erbakan, head of the Turkish Islamist party Refah, turned to Ahmed Huber for an introduction to the chief of the French party of the far right, again parenthetically Jean-Marie Le Pen. Exiting from the meeting, which took place in September of 1995, Huber's two friends supposedly stated that they, quote, share the same view of the world, unquote, and expressed, again, quote, their common desire to work together to remove the last racist obstacles that still prevent the union of the Islamist movement with the nationalist right of Europe, unquote. And skipping down, lastly, above Huber's desk is displayed a poster of the Imam Khomeini. "The meeting with Khomeini changed my life," Huber says, with stars in his eyes. For years after the Federal Palace in Bern, Ahmed Huber published a European press review for the Iranian leaders and then for the Turkish Refah Party. Since the former lacked financial means, Huber chose to put his efforts to the service of the Refah. An outpost of the Turkish Muslim Brothers, Refah thus became Huber's principal employer, and it was through the intermediary of the Turkish Islamist Party that this former parliamentary correspondent became a shareholder in the Bank Al-Taqwa. And an account in the Bank Al-Taqwa maintained by Ali bin Musa Alim had an unlimited line of credit for Al-Qaeda. When information about this emerged following the publication of a Treasury Department letter in 2004, Ali bin Musa Alim was found dead in his Swiss apartment. Turns out he'd been under indictment in the U.S. since the early 1980s for conspiring to corner the silver market. So that basically, that is the moderation of the Turkish Refah Party and the Turkish AK Party. This is what we're told we're not supposed to fear. A couple of interesting things. Of course, the Libyan uprising, unquote, has now turned into a war of sorts. We're running low on time. I don't think, frankly, that is likely to work out very well at all. I don't think although the Obama administration is helping to carry forward to an extent the covert operation begun during the closing phases of the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, I don't think they're on top of things at all. And I think this is going to prove profoundly destabilizing to the Obama administration. Indeed, I don't think they're particularly clear on just what is going to be going on in Libya. More about that as events develop. Interesting article in the Rolling Stone magazine, issue of the full URL will be available in the description to the program. March 21st of 2011, actually, is this particular issue. This is called U.S. Bombs Libya Helps Jihadists, and it reads in part, "America is now at war to protect a Libyan province that's been an epicenter of anti-American jihad. In recent years, at mosques throughout eastern Libya, radical imams have been, quote, urging worshippers to support jihad in Iraq and elsewhere, according to WikiLeaks cables. More troubling, the city of Derna, east of Benghazi, was a wellspring, unquote, of suicide bombers that targeted U.S. troops in Iraq. By imposing a no-fly zone over eastern Libya, the U.S. and its coalition partners have effectively embraced the breakaway public of Cyrenaica. As you can see on the map above, Libya is a mashup of three historically distinct provinces. As recently as the 1940s, Cyrenaica, and I may be mispronouncing that, was an independent emirate with its capital in Benghazi. And skipping down, flash forward to 2008. A West Point analysis of a cache of al-Qaeda reports discovered that nearly 20% of foreign fighters in Iraq were Libyans, and that, on a per capita basis, Libya nearly doubled Saudi Arabia as the top source of foreign fighters. The word fighter here is misleading. For the most part, Libyans don't go to Iraq to fight. They went to blow themselves up, along with American GIs. Among those whose work, unquote, was detailed in the al-Qaeda reports, 85% of the Libyans were listed as suicide bombers. And basically turning to yet another story, this from the British Telegraph, an article by Duncan Gardam, headlined, Libyan rebel commander admits his fighters have al-Qaeda links. In an interview with the Italian newspaper Il Sole 24 Ore, Mr. al-Hasidi admitted that he had recruited, a quote, around 25, unquote, men from the Dernia area in eastern Libya to fight against the coalition troops in Iraq. Some of them, he said, are, quote, today on the front lines in Ajibadaya. Mr. al-Hasidi insisted his fighters are good patriots and good Muslims, not terrorists, unquote, but added that, quote, members of al-Qaeda are also good Muslims and are fighting against the invader, unquote. Something to keep in mind as we listen to the pronouncements about how moderate the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is, and people may say that, well, the discussion from John Roy Carlson's book took place decades ago, and that the Brotherhood now has peaceful intent. Recall the following, this from WMD Insights, November 2006 issue, Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood presses government for nuclear weapons, bearing in mind the apparent alliance between the Brotherhood and the Egyptian army. In the summer of 2006, after pressing the Egyptian government for more than a year to restart the country's nuclear power program, the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's foremost political opposition force, escalated its nuclear goals and openly called for Egypt to develop nuclear weapons as a counter to Israel's nuclear capabilities. And something to contemplate as we contemplate the Salafi group and people directly connected to Sheikh Rahman and to the assassination of Anwar al-Sadat now expressing, quote, political freedom, unquote, in Egypt. Be interesting to see where things go. The British Daily Mail has an interesting article to contemplate in that context. This from February 2nd of 2011. World on brink of nuclear 9/11, unquote, as al-Qaeda plans large dirty bomb, unquote. Al-Qaeda is attempting to stockpile dirty radioactive explosives that could be used to target British troops or for a larger urban attack. It has emerged. New diplomatic documents released by WikiLeaks show that U.S. intelligence personnel have been informed of terrorist attempts to acquire dangerous amounts of uranium and plutonium. The cables warn of a large trafficking operation of chemical weapons material and threats of a nuclear 9/11, unquote, unless the West intervenes swiftly. Well, who knows if that's actually what the memo said, or is this WikiLeaks once again setting the stage for something that they may actually be participating in? Anyway, food for thought and grounds for further research. That, of course, was just a few years ago. That was not such a long time in the past, was it? This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 738, Turkish Taffy, Part 2. This is being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.